boys. Looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I'm joined on double feature today with harmonica wielding something from the second movie as well, Michael Kester.
Yeah, I have a harmonica. I can't start that way. Welcome to Double Feature, a podcast where we pair two films that seemingly have no relation until you find out who wrote which one.
It's true.
In which case you find out that you maybe paired it a little too well. Let's put it that way.
That was my thought too. But we can do this. This is easy. we got some Argento on both of the movies. We're hanging out in Italy. But yep. Also, we got some Morricone scores. And
right.
That's all the reason we need today is just...
I know. I mean, come on.
Watch some Morricone movies. It's fine. Don't make this too hard. That's my theme of the day. Don't make watching films too fucking hard.
You didn't kick off Once Upon a Time in the West and with that fly scene in the intro go, okay, well, there's one fly. How many more are we going to have?
Well, we have to really cement something important today on Double Feature, which is that another ongoing theme of this podcast is that movies are not scary. They are very easy. I know you put them in sometimes and it says 3 hours and you're like, whoa, man, I don't know about this. This looks... No, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You sit down, you watch the movie. It's not that hard. And today, even with these... we're going to talk about a lot of stuff I don't even know anything about. And two very, very particular genres that people are extreme fans of.
Mm-hmm.
And fuck it. That's fine. You just watch movies.
Yeah, that's fine.
Don't let people gatekeep your fucking movies. You watch whatever you want.
So we're going to cover Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, which is the first film in his unofficial Once Upon a Time trilogy.
The other two are Hollywood and Mexico. Are those the...
Correct.
Okay.
Nailed it.
See, guys, ignorance. It's
the
fine.
Second one in that trilogy, the name is fucking hilarious, but for another time, perhaps. And then we're pairing that with the Dario Argento movie, Four Flies on Grey Velvet.
The fourth fly in his fly trilogy. I don't know. Sorry.
This is late.
Low-hanging fruit, I don't know.
For anybody who's been with us from before the beginning of this year, which was just a couple episodes ago, we have done Argento on the show before. We've done a number of Dario Argento movies. He's somebody we like. He's a big thing we like. And so Four Flies on Grey Velvet, as we went into it this week, to me, felt like when you're dredging the barrels of what David Lynch movie you could be doing and you find yourself doing that stage play he directed and filmed.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
And watching the movie, I'll tell you at what point I realize we are in for just a normal Argento time, but I'm not going to tell you now. I'll tell you in 24 minutes because first up, we have this is easily one of my favorite films of all time. And it's Once Upon a Time in the West, which Ross Mahler brought to us today.
Oh, we get to talk about that for the first time as well.
That's right.
Who's this Ross Mahler? I don't see any Ross Mahler around here.
Anybody who was paying attention last week may have heard Ross Mahler's name at the end when we talked about our executive producers who got that title on our patreon.com/double feature. And another perk of giving to our patreon.com/double feature is that you get to choose films for us to do. And now, I want to be really honest, Ross gave us a really good list, and we will probably draw from that list a couple other times. But one of the things we like to do is pat ourselves on the back for picking movies we already wanted to do, but that somebody else suggested. So this is sort of one of those because Once Upon a Time in the West is probably like my third favorite movie of all time.
Yeah, sometimes you guys really surprise us with the picks. And sometimes it's like we've been trying to do Once Upon a Time in the West for literally half of our lives. And it is just, we never felt obligated to sit down and program it.
Right.
And then something had, you know, a big part of programming on the show is just keeping movies in the orbit long enough that when it comes time to reach up into the you know, Morricone discography and pull a couple movies out, we go, oh yeah, fucking finally, Once Upon a Time in the West, here we go. So yeah, I believe that URL is patreon.com/doublefeature. Just wanted to get a third plug in there.
So you too can choose films to put on our show. Not next week, though. That one's already set. After that, it's anyone's game.
John Doe has the upper hand.
Once Upon a Time in the West.
Oh, there's going to be spoilers too. I just put that out there. I'm probably going to complain about who's the real killer in Four Flies on Grey Velvet. So just know that's coming.
Once Upon a Time in the West is, in my opinion, the quintessential ultimate spaghetti Western. I personally, because of my affinity for a spaghetti Western, I would say it is the best Western of all time. Mm. Not to be confused with the very famous hotel chain. But
what a fucking random.
For those of you who are not familiar, welcome to Double Feature. A spaghetti Western is a Western film that is produced, shot, and largely filled by Italy.
Yeah.
You'll notice that in Once Upon a Time in the West, a lot of the audio is dubbed. Even the harmonica, which I think is sometimes one of the more troubling aspects of the movie, but I will always look away from it.
Whoa. Michael's a musician. He can say that.
A lot of the speech is sometimes dubbed or just voiced over, right? Like Jason Robard speaks English, who plays Cheyenne.
Yeah.
However, he had to go back and do his own voiceover because they probably on certain days just flat out were like, these are mostly Italians. We're not bringing a microphone. Or it was just fucking windy.
Well, as we've seen with actually a lot of these foreign movies and especially Italian movies, they just didn't do sync sound. Mm-hmm. They straight up just did not record sound. And I think we've probably discussed that in some of the giallo before and some of the spaghetti Westerns. So it has that commonality with it, but I'm glad you bring up spaghetti Western because this is, you know, this is not the same as the American Western. I think that's
right.
That's one of the things that to me is the most special about Once Upon a Time in the West and why I favor this over, not just me. I mean, this is genre fans, I feel like, this is my read of the room. Genre fans prefer spaghetti Westerns to American Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
American Westerns can be very rah-rah America, very moralistic. And the spaghetti Westerns just feel, they're not horror films. They don't always even feel like exploitation in the way that we usually think of the Hennenlotter style exploitation.
I would say a note on the exploitation level of spaghetti Westerns is I think it's retroactive and I think it's Quentin Tarantino's fault. I think Quentin Tarantino drew so much on exploitation and also so much on spaghetti Westerns that in hindsight, they look like they're part of the same family.
Yeah, I always felt like they had this inclusion. There's a lot more legitimate filmmaking in Once Upon a Time in the West than there is in many, many things we call an exploitation film.
For sure.
Although I would still say that that's another commonality between these movies is the plots are just, they're not impossible to follow, but they do sort of, they take the scenic route. How about that?
Wow. Yeah, that's a really effective way to put that. Good for you.
I was vamping for a pleasant way to say that.
I think that that comes from something that's very European in its cinematic storytelling. Something that a lot of people sort of in the 2000s just sort of swept under the rug of it's French, like we used to do.
Oh, yeah.
But what I think it's French actually means is it respects its audience intelligence.
Sure.
And I think that in Once Upon a Time in the West, there's so much that isn't said, but is very easily inferred.
Yeah.
The whole thing of who even is this woman is covered in three or four lines of dialogue, but it isn't explicitly stated who this woman is. You have a guy who has some children. They're all redheads. You know, they're his. And he goes, you're going to go pick up your mom. And the kid goes, not my mom. my mom died 6 years ago. And then the kid goes, what does she even look like? Boom, you have all the information you need.
Yeah, yeah.
She's never met this family before. She's a new mother. She's coming out here for the first time. They have no familiarity with her. She doesn't know where she's going. I mean, there is so much that you can glean from that. But in a more Americanized version of this film, you might get something more along the lines of, well, son, you know that when I was in New Orleans, I went and got married and she's moving out here for us. Today is July 5th. Right. So, you know, like
6:25 p.m. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like, okay, thanks for the exposition. And I feel like the whole movie goes that way. I feel like the movie favors, it's much like Harmonica's character. Much like Cheyenne says about Harmonica's character, the movie plays when it should talk.
Yeah.
And when it should talk, it plays.
Well, it's funny. We've been talking a lot about these TV guide style synopsises of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you'll notice if you do just, you know, browse a lot of various movie synopsises is that sometimes you'll find, you know, with an older movie, with a movie that's remarkable for some reason, that you don't get a description of what's happening in the movie. You get a description of its sort of historical importance. And I don't really want to say specifically, you know, go on a quest, get your own data, find the sort of how people describe this movie. But I think to sit down and describe the plot misses what's important about Once Upon a Time in the West. It seems like such an afterthought. Could you imagine talking to somebody about this movie? A third person walks up and goes, what are you guys talking about? And you're like, well, this guy who owns some land with mm-hmm. the town water source, he dies. And so the inheritance falls to his wife and they want to build a fucking highway through it or
right.
what yeah. a railroad right. through it.
Wild West Chinatown.
Yeah, it's like, it would, like imagine somebody describe, or even Roger, Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Right.
Oh, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Why should I watch that? What's that about? Well, you see, they want to build a new metro station.
Want to build a highway system.
The Jersey Turnpike is like, you'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? If right. you haven't seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it's a live action meets cartoons. I mean, I think yeah. everybody knows the movie.
Right.
Once Upon a Time in the West, it's like, yeah, you could describe, oh, we want to build a railroad, but this person owns the land, so we send this guy over to kill off.
Right.
And a vengeance plot falls right in the middle. None of that has anything to do with the real importance of the film, which is all tone, style,
yeah.
how the story is told, 100%.
Pacing. I think you can't have a 3-hour movie like Once Upon a Time in the West without talking about its pacing.
Yeah.
It feels like one of the most epic movies. And it's partially because of not only its length, but because of the pacing and the fact that you're at least 3 out of 4 of your main characters sit there and think about the next 4 words they're going to say every time anybody speaks to them.
Yeah.
Somebody talks to Frank and he just kind of looks at him with the most evil fucking eyes on planet Earth and yeah. then says like some smart ass shit that doesn't make sense. And then you think about it and you go, oh, I see what you, when Cheyenne says, you know, you kill 4 people, it's not hard to make it 5. And then she asks Harmonica, what are you doing here? And he goes, you kill 4 people. It's not hard to make it 5. It's like, how is that just like a colloquialism that everybody just has in this movie?
Stop trying to make it a thing, Leone. That's what you're doing there.
But it answers so many questions in
Leone,
so few
really
words.
The Diablo Cody of today. Which is like, Skittlebop's going to be a name that kids call each other. I'm telling you it is.
It's so funny. But yeah, I mean, the plot is... convoluted has this negative connotation, but it's true. It's, you know, it is a Western. So of course it has to do with greed and the railroad. Duh.
Yeah,
it is still a Western movie. So there's, you know, a railroad track that's going through the desert and steam engines need water because steam needs water. And this guy has the only water source in the desert.
Yeah.
Right. And so you have sort of a, a like thrice removed murder plot where one guy is hired to go kill the guy who owns the water, but then that guy turns even more evil. The thing that's amazing is the plot seems super dense, and we talk about this a lot, but the plot seems super dense, but not over 3 hours.
Yeah.
We talk all the time about how I will watch a movie for 3 hours if you have 3 hours worth of shit to tell me, but don't make an hour and 27 minute flick 2 hours and 45 minutes because I will know you're doing that.
So what do you think it does with the extra 2 hours of 2 hours and 20 minutes of runtime?
Well, I've thought about that this most recent time I watched it. I've seen this movie so many times, but I was basically watching for downtime.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really any downtime. There are lingering shots and long pauses between conversations. In some case, I think the opening scene is exactly the way to view what goes on with the pacing.
Yeah.
Because I think that scenes like that are intentionally slow, not to be sluggish, but to build tension and anticipation.
Yeah.
It does a lot with the audio and the score in those scenes. You know, the score, every single fucking character has a theme song in this.
Yeah.
And so that sort of like audiological narrative is really important to a movie that, like you said, probably isn't even like sync sound to begin with.
Yeah.
So the fucking soundscape building is doing a lot of heavy lifting for that railroad scene at the beginning with the water dripping, with the fly, not only the fly, but the fly in the gun, out of the gun, around all of these things. It's basically nothing happening, but the tension just builds and builds and builds. And then, of course, the final, I don't know what you'd call it, tableau of Harmonica hopping off the train. He delivers, you know, one of the best one-liners in Western history and then kills all three guys.
Please.
He says, did you bring me a horse? And they say, no, looks like we're one horse short. And he says, nope, you brought two too many.
Yeah.
And then kills all three of them.
Yeah, that opening scene. I mean, this is something I want to center in on for a second, because if you look at this movie compared to the Man with No Name films that Leone did, they are also, they're very big, very well-known Westerns. And they operate a little bit more on the border of spaghetti Western. I think maybe because of their popularity, some people don't consider them spaghetti Westerns, even though, like, look, it's literally the same fucking director. But let's put that whole unnecessary genre nonsense to the side. I think they're worth looking at together because the style in the Man with No Name movies, if you've seen The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, so much of that film is what we think of as Mexican standoffs. These sort of just tense, staring at each other, sweaty fingers, you know, over the hammer of the gun, getting ready to draw, just staring each other down. And what's kind of interesting about Once Upon a Time in the West is you've described the same, yeah, we spent a lot of time building tension and sort of waiting for these periods before the action happens. But I don't feel like it's the same Mexican standoff kind of way that we have in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly or some of the other Leone movies. I think we spend a lot more time, I mean, it's a lot more quizzical to me because the way it reads just looking at it is sort of like nothing happens and then bam, action. Nothing happens, and then really unexpected death. I would say unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just waiting around. It's like, wow, this room's oddly quiet. Somebody dies. And what I think really builds the tension here isn't the cutting camera, the framing, the sort of moving from gun to face to sweaty brow to hat brim closer and closer and closer. It's the fucking sound.
Mm-hmm.
All of the images even that you described in the opening scene, they're all attached to very deliberate sounds. And I think one of the things that makes the runtime feel a lot shorter is that it's almost like listening to music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same. It's the same fucking reason we have hold music, really. I mean, you play a song, it passes time.
Right.
You know, you can get into the rhythm of something. Repetition doesn't drive people crazy the same way. And even where it does, that's used to effect too. It reminds me of Kill Bill a lot.
Sure.
It's probably one of the first times I noticed, you know, I think Kill Bill's inspired by this a lot. You talked about Tarantino. But the sort of staring each other down and just hearing the gentle repetitious sound, and it does almost become maddening,
right?
Because you wonder how many loops of this sound am I going to get through before something terrible, like, are we going to make it to the next one? Okay, we're here. Are we going to make it to the next one?
And I think too, sort of to contrast it to from a lot of Westerns, despite the fact that this of course has your classic Western hat color coding, I don't know if you're paying attention, but it is well intact.
Oh, good.
Frank is a black hat, Cheyenne's a brown hat, Harmonica's a light tan, and she has the white hat on. So okay, great. Innocence levels covered. But
who needs our D&D chart when we've got the infallible Leone hat color?
But I think what's really one of the things that I find so enthralling about this movie and why it will always be one of, if not my absolute favorite Western, is because these characters are not two-dimensional. They're not dumb. They're not just in the room. I get it. You're going to do a dumb, you know, there's complexity to them. Obviously Harmonica's complexity comes from the fact that he's mysterious, right? I'm not trying to say that he is one of the most complex characters in cinema history, but he's not well labeled under the good.
Yeah.
Like maybe another person might be in a different spaghetti Western.
Sure.
And
the cut of the poncho is not a labeling system at use in this,
right.
in this film.
But I think that makes the movie a lot more interesting because even Frank, who is a very bad, bad guy.
Mm.
I mean, like the film goes out of your way. He's fucking kicking people's crutches out from under him. He's doing literally the fucking bad guy playbook to be the worst guy.
Yeah.
But there is still something about him where you can be in a room with him and not think he's going to kill you. You know what I mean? He has a sort of depth where he even understands that guns have a time and place.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that he will just wantonly murder children. And I think that that sort of complexity makes it interesting. And the movie plays with that a lot by combining these two characters in different sort of permutations. One of the most interesting scenes, I think, for that is when Harmonica is watching Frank walk through the town when they're trying to assassinate him. And this is, you know, you've kind of got from the beginning, again, through small pieces of dialogue, that Harmonica is here to get Frank.
Yeah.
That is pretty plain right off the fucking train. And so to see him,
it's the wrinkle in the municipal planning.
Right.
Schedule here.
Right. Like he says it too. Again, the dialogue, where it is there, it is everything. But she says, you saved his life. And he said, I didn't let them kill him. And that's not the same thing.
Yeah.
And that sort of like these dynamics between these characters, fucking.
You could feel the unfolding in the page of the revenge plot. It's like,
yeah.
Okay. And now if we open page 35,
exactly.
The revenge plot.
And there's also just like little things where Harmonica turns in Cheyenne for the fucking reward.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no on-screen or off-screen dialogue whereby Harmonica goes, don't worry, I'm sure you'll get out of it. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Harmonica just knows you escape from shit. And if you don't, I guess I don't really fucking care.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, of course, another wonderful quip in that tiny scene too. But it's
what
just,
I think lets them get away with that sort of mysterious character aspect of it is the fact that it's Charles Bronson and it's Henry Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Henry Fonda specifically, you know, this
supposed to be the good guy.
Yeah, right. Well, so I mean, I think there's a lot of, I don't think, so there's two things at work in something like casting against type with Henry Fonda. One is that audiences know Henry Fonda's the good guy and then they go see this movie and they go, oh wait, he's not the good guy. But they bring that real world baggage of having seen his face painted on the posters.
Sure.
2 miles high. Well,
he was the lead in My Darling Clementine, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which we did. We have another thing. We'll talk about it later. It's called additional content. You're going to love it.
But the other element of that is not just the audience association, but literally how Henry Fonda, he spent his whole life playing good guys. So when he plays a bad guy, yeah, a lot of the action of the script is I do bad things. But he has a way of carrying himself where he's excelled in all these heroic parts. I don't think it's a stretch to say he's just naturally going to bring that with him. So there's just a little something, you know, I didn't grow up with Henry Fonda, but I still watch him in this movie and feel like, oh, he's playing a softer version of this, or it's not, you know, that's part of what's delicious about it, is it's not softer, it's not like he's more sympathetic, but something about the way he carries himself
mm-hmm.
is a little bit more like they do with, sometimes they'll do this with casting a Bond villain or something like that. Just a person you've associated so much with one role, and now they come to this and it's sort of like, look at their weird take on it because of what kind of performer they are. And probably the themes lend something to that too. I mean, we just cannot state, and maybe this is a good transition into the next movie, but the Morricone stuff, this is such a moody film, and we'll give full credit to Leone for building the atmosphere in all of his movies. Obviously, he was great at that. But fuck if that sound, that guitar and harmonica kind of mix, the way the harmonica and all the higher parts in the score just ooze mood. It's like the way people will talk about a violin weeping as it's played.
Right.
I mean, that's really how it feels. And these were not, you know, these were not just bits that Morricone went back to time and time again. Like, I don't know, I don't need to throw down any American composers, but some of the best known American composers kind of have a signature thing that they do.
Right.
And what's funny is everybody's now thinking of one, and they're probably all thinking of different people. But mm-hmm. they kind of have like a trick. And the Morricone scores, fuck if this, you know, you remember we talked about The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and how much different, how it kind of had those vocal chant pieces to it, or how For a Few Dollars More had this like creepy bell thing that it was doing. He manages to find a hook into the mood in each of these movies. It's a different instrument, it's a different mood, it's a different kind of technique. And it's part of what makes the movies feel so iconic. And so you hear the piece of music, you immediately think of a scene, or you immediately think of the film. But you don't think, oh yeah, which this is like one of those Morricone scores, right? Which one is this? You don't have that problem with him the way you do so many other composers who are very good. But, you know, I can get lost in some of their themes sometimes, where I'm just like, oh yeah, put on a soundtrack of this person or this person. Oh, which movie is this? Oh, which one is this? Is this the same as the last one? You know, Once Upon a Time in the West sticks out. Well, let's say from Four Flies and Grey Velvet, which sounds nothing alike.
Right.
The use of music is, you know, nothing alike.
But we do have a second Italian film scored by Ennio Morricone with Dario Argento involved that stars a tortured musician. So look at us doing our damn job.
Yeah, I mean, if we weren't explicit about it before, Argento was one of the writers credited, but wrote Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah, he shows up on all those movies that I think are my best of a genre. And then just turns out like, yeah, and just so you know, Dario Argento wrote Dawn of the Dead. So that's where that came from.
right. Just likes to show up. Yeah. Four Flies, I think, also has this this kind of statement summary issue where, you know, I want to tell people watch the movie before they listen to the show. And then people go, I'm not watching the movie. Just tell me what happened in the movie. And then I sort of feel like, well, Four Flies and Grey Velvet, I'm not really sure I could tell you anything of substance that would help you out here.
Right.
It's a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody witnesses a murder. There are odd events that happen in the sequence of the... I'm telling it from a weird perspective too.
Mm-hmm.
A guy commits a murder sort of in self-defense, and there's another dude taking pictures. We don't know who he is. And then these kind of, as pieces of the murder start unfolding, we find that there's another player in it who's kind of out to get all these people. But that makes it sound like it's a murder mystery with a bunch of clues where you could figure out who done it. And
it kind of sounds like Knives Out. But Italian.
Yeah, there's no figuring out the final scene of this movie. You know, like that, I actually feel like trying to tell people what we're talking about is a disservice to the movie if you haven't seen it, because then you think you could go into it and figure it out.
Right.
And man, there is no quicker way to hate Four Flies and Grey Velvet than be like, I'm going to guess who the killer is.
Well, and so that brings me back to what I was saying at the top of the show, where Four Flies on Grey Velvet, probably because the title has 11 words in it or whatever, roughly rounding up to 11. I kind of always just thought of it as not really like one of the main Argento. Come on. Like, it's not one of the main Argento movies, but sure, Argento's a busy guy. He's made movies before.
Yeah.
He's no Takashi Miike, but he does get around. And so I'm watching this movie and I'm like, yeah, I mean, you know, I guess it feels like an Argento movie.
Hey, I'm walking here. What are you doing?
And then the fucking mask. And I'm like, oh, I was wrong. I've been very wrong this whole time.
He just can't stop himself. Yeah.
As soon as I see the mask, I'm just like, this is it. For any of you guys following along with the show starting this year, this isn't the worst Argento movie to start with, I think is my point.
Yeah.
That it feels just as vividly Dario Argento as most of, you know, as Deep Red or not quite Phenomena Creepers, because that holds a special place in my Argento.
Although I think there's some overlap I want to talk about with that movie too.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well,
but I think,
sorry.
Yeah, no, I think, sorry. Well, no, that's my point. You're right. No, my point, you should have just cut me off because I didn't have shit to say. My point is that it's just as much an Argento movie as anything else.
Yeah, well, we get these immediate giallo feels from this. And, you know, you've often used giallo as your go-to genre of...
I know what you're going to say.
I want to feel a certain way. Nothing else gives me this, yep. Right? I mean, I can just hear the words coming out of your mouth. And it's so true. Even after everything that I've learned about filmmaking, after everything that you and I have watched, all of the things we've talked about together and opinions we've shared and people have written in and all of it, I still feel like at this point in my life, no matter how jaded I become, I put on a giallo movie. And it just always feels like I'm sitting in a theater in Chicago in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Or next to a steam radiator in an apartment ordering a late night pizza or something. It just takes me back. It's like a fucking sense memory. And I don't want to say that feeling's going to be uniform for everyone, but I do know a lot of people who, you know, they take out the DVD and they feel a special energy radiating off the disc full of lasers when they put it in. It transports them to another time and place that is impossible today, even with the films that have tried to recreate it, just to authentically go back to that moment, whatever that was. And so once again, we have a movie that's not really about what it's about, but it's about how it's about it. And so we see all the Argento things that we've always talked about as being part of giallo, but are probably more in the horror. You know, we've even talked about that on Suspiria, which strictly speaking is not a giallo movie. But we start to associate a lot of the things he does in there because we see his signature in that movie and we see it in, you know, something more like one of his detective films, let's say, one of his pulpy
mm-hmm.
yellow novel detective movies. So that's fixations on objects. It's sort of the odd actors. It's certainly the way the sound plays into it. But for me, I think the thing that keeps me coming back to these movies, even when they are the worst of executions, is the utter seriousness with which it does these ridiculous sort of executes these ridiculous plots. These kind of, in this movie, it's the retina, the sort of the good old, the retina holds the image, last retained several hours later, you know, that plot that you and I probably know from Fringe.
Right.
But has been in movies since, you know, the 30s. And in literature since like the 1800s. This is an old pulpy detective sort of, we backed ourselves into a corner. How are we going to figure out who the killer is? We killed everybody. Oh, well, just so you know, the last image is burned onto the retina and we can just use a microscope or whatever. And voila, here it is. And the way that this movie approaches that, even that very thing, not even just to say the whole affair, but even that very scene is sort of like a character goes, you may never have heard this before if you're new to fiction, but this image is burned on the retina. And the other character goes, interesting. And then like turns 90 degrees and basically just smash cut holds up the results. It's like, oh, here's the image. Let's go get the guy. You know, like it's a thing that's not real, that requires such a suspension of disbelief to a modern audience. And yet this movie just dismisses it so summarily as if,
right.
Oh, did you know about the Deus Ex Machina that the entire audience will go along with? No. Do you have it written down somewhere? Yes, I've got it right here. And then we move on with it. And so it's full of, you know, it's full of the same type of slasher murdery stuff that we'll talk about in a cheap disposable horror movie, but it goes after it with the seriousness of solving the case that I just find so endearing. That's just part of who I am as a human. I love serious things. I love when people try to give something an earnest effort.
Right.
Instead of throwing it away for jokes. Even in a movie.
Well, that's
like,
Argento's. That's Argento's.
That's what I was going to say.
Main thing.
I mean, yeah. He's actually passing up really good jokes in order to treat it with earnestness. And that's what I really fucking love, because that lets us as the audience watch the monkey Ahab in his movie or whatever crazy thing he pulls out. And we're sort of like, are you serious with this? And he's like, yeah, absolutely. This is a very serious matter. It's So, you know, in this movie, it's also the characters. You know, it seems like it's the thing that reminded me of the Jennifer Tilly film, is that we have this cast of these just sort of eccentric, you know, the bohemian guy, the professor, or this gay private investigator who's kind of written to be, that part's actually pretty interesting to me because it's written to be very big and then it's played like kind of subtle, which is a cool meeting of the minds on that managed to make that part like actually kind of cool when it could have been a little cringy.
Sure.
Had somebody really like fucking birdcaged it up.
That's you true. Know what I mean? Yeah. That's another thing these two films have in common is a one cringy moment.
You know, so these are things that we've seen before in other Argento movies. And I think what makes this one stand out is that it's a lot different than the horror icon ones. There aren't really scares that are built in the same way. It's not as about the shock of the blood or the, you know, the other ones really were a lot pulpier.
Right.
They really were a lot more blood on the floor, razors near the eyes, bird pecking out the... What did a bird peck something out in that movie?
I think it's all the same movie you're describing, yes. Yeah. Possibly the same scene, but...
No one plays a phantom of an opera in this movie, which makes it unlike at least 12 other Argento movies that I could name. So, look, if you don't know Dario Argento and any of that sounds amusing to you, boy, do you have a wild ride ahead of you.
Yeah.
Why don't you pick up some of those movies and enjoy your week of Argento film watching.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want to talk about a wild ride ahead of you, we are on episode 3 of this year of Double Feature.
Does seem crazy. And we're already into Four Flies on Grey Velvet.
Right? So, you know, we have a website, that's doublefeature.fm. We spent a lot of time a few days ago coming up with pairs from movies you guys suggested, coming up with pairs of movies that we suggested for ourselves. Coming up, you know, I was looking back on it. There are like pairs of movies that like I know neither you nor I even like, but we did pair them.
Yeah.
We just kind of went, what would be a good pair for this? I don't really like that movie. And then we picked another movie and it just happened to not be a film we liked, but damn well going to be a good pair if it ever ends up on the show. That's not the case next week. I'll tell you that much because I haven't seen the films that we're going to do next week.
Great.
Again, big thanks to Ross Mahler for putting Once Upon a Time in the West on the show. I love that movie. I'm really happy that we got to do it. And, you know, sorry that Ennio Morricone died. Earth, you lost a good one.
I know, but I'm so glad we actually got to take a moment to just look at two random pieces of his art.
Yeah.
We really don't do that enough. You know, there's, to go back to that idea of gatekeepers, I mean, I don't ever want this is not the best show to learn about Ennio Morricone.
Right.
I don't know that you'll know a single thing about him now that you didn't know at the start of the show. In fact, maybe less. So I know putting two Morricone movies on the show, that this isn't the best place to learn about him. And we're not really going to we're not the right people to spend 45 minutes breaking down his scores.
But if you want a thesis on the Leone hat theory, I got you.
Yeah, right. Right. That is what the show is. But yeah, at the same time, I felt like after he died, I don't want ignorance to be an obstacle to knowledge itself or to even just immersion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want people out there to have the feeling like, oh, Morricone just died. Oh, I don't really know a lot about music. And this is a composer that's very revered and people talk about him in a sophisticated way. I better just not enjoy any of those movies.
Right.
And I kind of wanted to say fuck that and pick up two random movies that he has scored various degrees of the music that actually appears in.
Mm-hmm.
And just talk about the movies. And, you know, you watch two more things he scored and two more things he scored. And before long, you kind of have a sense of what it is.
Right.
This is my long way of saying thanks to Ross. For allowing us to do
and
that.
I think Ennio Morricone in another world would have been a really cool thing to do for like this year's journey. It's just like pair Ennio Morricone with question mark. Sorry, I'm on the spot. Don't have time to think about it. Or even an additional content of all Ennio Morricone, which I said I was going to get back to. So I'll get back to it right now. So we have a patreon.com/doublefeature. We do this thing when we make our monthly goal so that we can keep this show just running. That's all we're doing. We're just keeping the show running. When we hit that, we will take additional content ideas from the Patreons, the people who are giving to the show. And what those can be, it's basically a fucking free-for-all, but it is private, it is exclusive, and it's essentially a whole sub-show that runs under Double Feature. A great example would be you could flat out be like, yo, I put in for an additional content, and I want you guys to do 5 Ennio Morricone movies, and I want you to do these 5 in this fucking order.
Yeah.
And we'll do that. We will do that. We will record that episode, and we will only put it out to Patreon subscribers. So whether or not you want to even, you have an idea for additional content, you can't even listen if you're not on the Patreon. So just another reason to go to patreon.com/doublefeature and help us keep the fans running on the servers. 4 dudes who helped us do that this week. We've got Charles Crawford, Ben Ecker, John, and Brett Hayton. Thank you so much for executive producing Double Feature. And because of you, I get to watch 2 movies I've never seen before next week.
What is it? Let me know. I need to also know the movies.
Next week, we're going to do two movies. We're going to do a film called First Cow, which I presume is about a first cow, and a film called The Rider, which I'm confident is about a rider.
First Cow and The Rider. That's the show.
Right. And if I'm wrong, you know, just make believe it's nothing. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.